Every time I talk to my agent, he's like, it's like we're at a funeral together. And he's just like, yeah, maybe there'll be some leftover potato salad when we get to the reception.
Oh my God.
Hi, it's Lindsay Hunter. I'm the host of I'm a Writer But, a podcast where writers talk to a writer about anything.
I get it. If people don't want to read about like the adult diapers that you wear after you have a baby, like that's totally fine. But let's not pretend that those can't be just as literary as like, I don't know, you know, Philip Roth's Erection.
I wish you a wide audience, but you know, for this episode, you know, I feel like maybe people will turn it off a couple minutes in, and that's okay with me.
I'm a Writer But is a production of Lit Hub Radio and is available now wherever you get your podcasts.
The vocation we have chosen is a veil of tears.
Welcome to the Maris Review. I'm Maris Kreisman, and we have a very special guest today. Miriam Parker is the associate publisher of Echo, which is where my memoir is going to come out eventually, I hope. Miriam is also the author of The Shortest Way Home and Room and Board, which is the one we're talking about today. She has an MFA in creative writing from UNC Wilmington and a BA in English from Columbia University. She lives in Brooklyn with her husband, daughter, and spaniel, Leopold Bloom. And Miriam, I remember the day you acquired Leopold Bloom.
Oh, it was a day that will live in infamy.
Indeed. But I love this last line of your bio because it's like kind of gets to the heart of, I think, something that you and I didn't know when we first met each other, which is that it gets better.
Yes, it does. Well, we were set up on a friend date by an ex-boyfriend of mine.
Yes.
It was like the best thing that ever happened to me.
Me too. I was really in the shits.
I know. And I had just come back to New York from grad school and I like didn't really know what I was doing. And I like didn't really have any friends anymore. And like, I didn't live in Brooklyn at the time either. I was still living in Manhattan. And I was like, this is not like nothing is working. You know, like I hated where I lived and I didn't have a dog and I was like about to break up with this boyfriend. Basically, yeah. He was like, here's my parting gift to you. I'm going to set you up on a date with a person who I think you'll really like.
I love that because Room and Board is such that book. Like you can, the idea that like, if you don't like your life or certain aspects of your life, you can change it.
Yeah. And it's funny because both of my books are about someone who like runs away from their New York life to do something else. And like,
who's Sonoma?
Yeah. Right. I mean, and I will say like, whenever I talk about it, I'm like, well, I've never done that. I've always lived in New York. And like, but it's actually, now that I talk to you about it, it's kind of not true. Like I did go to grad school to kind of like escape my New York life. And then I came back. But I definitely, you know, when I was young, had this idea that if I just move would get better, which is like sort of true and sort of not true. Like I do believe that wherever you go, there you are. Like you're still yourself. Yeah. Unfortunately.
Yeah.
But I think that in this book, like Jillian kind of figures that out. Like she runs away from being a publicist, but it turns out she's a publicist, and like her publicity skills like come in handy wherever it is that she is. So I think that's, you know, I think that wherever you go, there you are kind of, you know, rings true in this book, even though, but you can change the circumstances that lead to different outcomes, which I think is what mm-hmm. both of us have done.
Yeah. And I think it's always, I mean, I think both of your novels are fantasy novels in a way. Like, yeah, the idea of pulling that escape hatch, like that you could go somewhere with great wine and nice weather and, I even like the idea that what Jillian is looking for, because I think this is true of you too, and maybe stop me if I'm misspeaking, but like the calm that she feels in Sonoma,
yeah,
is something that you could probably feel elsewhere, even in New York City. It just takes some work.
Yeah. I mean, I went to the beach this weekend and I kind of felt it there. I mean, you can within like 30 minutes get out of your like hustle bustle life and like get to the beach. Or like even like, I mean, I'm really lucky to live right near Prospect Park. And like during the pandemic, there's a little part I would there's a little place in Prospect Park where there are all these birds kind of, you know, hang out. And I would go there on my lunch break and just like look at birds. And like sometimes I brought bird seed and it was calm and you couldn't hear cars and there weren't that many people around. So like there are places you can kind of escape to even in New York. But I will say when I lived in North Carolina and I would come back to New York, the minute I would get off the plane, like my heart would start to race and I would turn in back into that New Yorker immediately who was like, get out of my way.
You start walking more quickly.
Yeah.
Another thing I love about this book is we have very similar references. And so if on page one of the book, you have a young Jillian in high school singing As Cool As I Am by Dar Williams. Wow. Just
It's funny,
really.
that part is actually the last part of the book that I wrote. The book was all set in the present day, you know, the present time period, which is 2018, which I had to do because I didn't want there to be a pandemic in my book. But it, my Maya Ziv, who's my amazing editor, and I kind of we were like, there's just she was like, there's something kind of missing, and I think it's the past. And she was like, can you write a prologue? And I was like, I'll try. And so when I finished writing it, I was like, this is a love letter to like my fellow like late 1990s high school grads who loved a folk festival.
Absolutely. And truly, Miriam, I've known that song by heart since then.
Yeah.
But reading Room and Board made me kind of reevaluate the story of that song. Because I think one of the things that happens, Jillian was, we find out in high school at this boarding school. She had two best friends and they were both hot and they ended up dating and she was miserable, but for some reason she tended to have her anger focused mostly on the girl slash woman. I will not be afraid of women.
Yeah.
Tell me
That's
about that.
funny that, oh, I hadn't really thought, I well, be honest, I hadn't really thought about that. I do think it's true. I mean, my like personal life experience is that like when there's kind of like a love triangle, when anytime I've been involved in a love triangle, my rage always went towards the woman. And I don't know why, because it's not her fault.
It's really the person who created the love triangle.
Yeah. And I mean, the one thing I wanted to say about Jillian too is that she's not perfect. Like she's not blameless in the situation. And like I didn't want to have a character who was like, you know, this sort of like, woe is me. Like she did something wrong too. Like she, you know, and I don't think that, I mean, I like care like main characters who are like a little bit messy. Like you want to root for them, but you also, and it's possible there are people, I mean, that wouldn't root for her because she, you know, she like, you know, tried to like, you know, steal her best friend's boyfriend. Like that's something that someone might not like about her. But I hope is that she's made a mistake and that you kind of do root for her in the present to kind of like overcome whatever mistakes that she's made.
Yeah. And so I guess the idea that again, high school wasn't her favorite time in her life, but there is a comfort in like kind of almost like Drew Barrymoring and Never Been Kissed, like being able to go back there and do it over.
Yeah. And I don't, I mean, it's not something that like I've ever done or like recommend. I mean, occasionally I'll go back to my hometown, which my parents don't even live in anymore, and I'm like, this place is kind of funky. Yeah, so I mean, I've never like moved back to my hometown or like gone back. You know, I go back there occasionally. Like, yeah, I actually got and did get married in my hometown, which was, you know, so we had to go back a couple times. And my parents don't live there anymore, so it's really not my place anymore. But it is, you know, you walk down those sidewalks and you're like, I remember all these cracks because I looked at them so many times. You know, like it's a place like you're never gonna live anywhere as long as you lived in that place. If you live, like I lived in the same house my whole, you know, childhood and, you know, growing up. So I definitely, you have these kind of like ingrained memories, but you also like, you know, my whole hope the whole time I was in high school was like, I want to get away from this place. And I want to be a different person than I've been this whole time. And so I think that there's sort of this balance between like, you want to go back and fix the mistakes that you made, but you also want to be a new person, you know? And I think that that's kind of one of the things that's kind of happening in this book is she's like gone back to try to fix it or like reconnect it or whatever. But she also is like, she's grown up and she's been through a lot and she knows more about herself than she did. And she sees it in the kids that she's kind of mentoring. She's like, I see kind of the path that they're going to, that they could potentially take, or I kind of see who the people who they might be are. And I think she wants to help them maybe like avoid some of the mistakes she made or some of the mistakes she saw people make. And that's another thing when I was thinking about writing the book, I was like, you know, one of the things I'm very into is like intergenerational friendships and mentorship. And that, you know, that sounds kind of like corporate, but it's, you know, it seemed to me like something that could be part of a book. So here we are.
And so again, you didn't go to boarding school, but I really do love the way you describe the life of the dorm mom, which is what Jillian has signed up for.
Yeah. And it's sort of made up. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, I mean, I asked a few questions, but I will say that like, if someone really went to boarding school and reads this book and is like, this is not how it is, like they might be right. I don't know. But, I sort of thought about like the resident advisors when I was in college and like, I have, you know, knew a little bit about like how a boarding school works. And some of her experiences at the high school are a little bit like loosely based on my experience going to college. Cause that was definitely a shock for me. Especially the stuff about class, that definitely was something when I got to college, I was like, oh God, this world is way different from where I come from. So I think, but the role of a dorm mom is different than a resident advisor because they really need her. They're still kids. So I think, I mean, the experience of being a dorm mom is different than the experience of being a resident advisor because the kids are still kids, you know, and they need like, you know, someone to make sure they go to bed and someone to make sure that they do their homework. And also like someone to like tell them what, you know, like what life is because they're still kids, you know? And so even though these kids are rich and like, you know, they kind of are really craving that kind of, you know, parental support. And that's what she is to them.
Yeah. They're very explicit in saying like, no, you are called a dorm mom because you actually have to have this kind of maternal role. Yeah. And here she is, she's 37, 38.
I think she might be 38, I think.
And she has not had children yet and isn't sure if she wants to. And then she all of a sudden has many children.
Which maybe is like the ultimate instruction about whether you should or should not have children.
Some people watch the rehearsal, some people just have to become a dorm parent. I think one of the other things that struck me, and all the time I think about this, when Jillian was in high school, there was no internet, there was no method of communicating or researching somebody in the way there is now. And so when she gets to the gem, which is what the school is called, in 2018, she has no secrets. Everyone has Googled her.
Right. They Google her in front of her. Like, they're like, oh, I'm just going to check you out. Like, and it's not even like a pretension that you might go do it in private. It's like, oh, okay. And it's just like reading her, like, you know, Wikipedia, you know, her, like, you know, her press hits out to her, you know, that's like, that's what the world is like now. And I will say, like, it's terrifying. Like that you have a footprint anything, everything is a footprint everywhere. And so, and I look at the way that people get into trouble. People say one thing online and it just like spirals and like, it can change your life.
Yeah.
And like, so that was definitely something that I was just reacting to and, you know, and wanting to just like think about in the book, because it's something that I see happening. And I just find it terrifying when I see it happening. And I feel bad. Especially if it's someone who's made kind of like a mistake that they didn't know they made. And you're kind of like, oh, geez, this is rough, you know, and it can ruin your life.
I think that's true. Although you say in the book, a favorite line is that high school was the original cancel culture. You can be shunned by your peers, even without the help of social media. Right.
Except for that, I think now, like that, it just like everything is high school, you know, like Twitter is high school.
I think that's right. That's amazing. And so tell me a little bit, Miriam, about what these people are discovering about Jillian when they Google her. This is a part that you know a bit better than the boarding school part.
So, you know, it's like a little bit alluded to, but basically what happened is that Jillian was a celebrity publicist and she, you know, had clients, and one of her clients was a director who was a Me Too person who lied to her and told her he wasn't. And she defended him in public, helped him like kind of craft his image. And then it all came, you know, kind of barreling back on her. And as a result, she basically got canceled in public and got, you know, simultaneously she got canceled in public, but also all these other Me Too guys were like, oh, can you be my publicist? And she was like, mm-hmm. That's not the person I want to be. I don't want to be the, you know, the Me Too publicist who just defends, you know, gross men. And so, and she was like, and if that's what's going to happen to me, then I'm like, I'm not doing this anymore.
And so, and that's like such a, it is a career path now. Like,
oh, yeah. I mean, look at all the people who defend Trump, you know, I mean, not to go into politics, but like, there's like a whole world of like, that's your job, you know? And I don't know, that part of it, like, you have to respect someone being like, instead of like taking a bunch of money to do something that they don't stand behind, she was like, well, I'm just going to quit, you know?
Absolutely. That seems like the wise thing to do. It's good that she had a little, you know, money saved up.
She has an apartment that she can sublet as a back, you know, as a backstop, a nicely furnished apartment.
And I do love the way you portray her life in New York City and the brands of clothing she wears and the skincare she uses and the bar where she hangs out. Thank goodness she hangs out at one of my favorite kind of low-key bars and not like a fancy cocktail lounge.
Well, you got to have your home bar that's like a little bit, you know, like that there's like a little bit of grit on the ground. Mm-hmm.
But tell me about like another thing I was telling you before today was you have this whole section about what Jillian bought before she started at this school where she was going to be surrounded by rich people. And she had a nice pair of Banana Republic jeans and a pair of Mavi jeans, which really brought me back.
I had to like remember what like the brands were, you know, in 1996, and like what you would, even if you were at, you know, Filene's basement, like what would you like gravitate towards to get and be like, this is the cool thing. It's funny, when my first apartment by myself in New York City was on 13th Street between 3rd and 4th Avenue, and it was on the same block as the Palladium dorm for NYU. And every September, like late August, the kids would move in and I would see them wearing like what they thought was their cool New York outfit. And like, I could pick them out and be like, oh, that, you know, like, I can. And then by October, they had all blended in.
Wow.
And like figured out like what they were really supposed to wear. And it was so like, it was just this like weird magic thing that happened. Like, and you know, they were wrong when they first got here, but then they figured it out. So, and I don't know if I ever figured it out in college, but I will say that like, when I got there, I didn't have a lot of clothes and I didn't really know, like, and I just didn't know what it was like. I just, I had what I had. And, you know, my closet was not full. And I do remember, this is actually true, is that a girl walked into my room and looked in my closet. And she was like, well, where's the rest of your stuff? And I was like, that's all I have. And she was like, oh. And then I went to her room and it was like, she had like dry cleaning bags of everything. Her closet was exploding, you know? And I was just like, not, and, you know, I think this is in the book too. It's like, not only did she buy all the clothes, but she had to dry clean each one of them, you know, which is like another wardrobe. Like every time, even now when I dry clean my clothes, I'm like, I could have bought another thing.
Yeah. And then, and of course, in the apex of her life as a publicist, she finally has that closet.
Right. Well, and I think, I wonder, you know, I read a tweet thread of this the other day. Like, it's like one of those things that I wonder if that was what she really wanted, what she was always searching for, is like this sort of acceptance into that world that she had never quite figured out when she was in college. And so in some ways, like her whole career was her like just trying to get that acceptance, that like, you know, flash that she, you know, that she has in, that her friends just had in high school, you know?
And I love how so much of the book is then about her deciding what she wants to be next, and how to tone that look down a little bit, and like how to dress in a different way, like more work casual.
Right. Well, it's so much
like figuring out what actually makes her happy.
Right. And so much though about like culture is like, how do you, is like reading the room. It's like, do I, like, what is this room? And like, how am I gonna work in this room? You know? And I think as a publicist, she kind of gets that, but I think as a person, she might not. And I think that she's never quite like figured out how to like fit in at this school. And I think it's, again, as she goes back and she's like, I still don't fit in here. You know, mm-hmm. Like, I'm still not like accepted at the party. I'm not a teacher. I'm a dorm mom. I'm, you know, and things like that. So you know, she's always like a little bit of an outsider, kind of looking at the world and trying to figure it out.
But this time around, she makes like a true blue friend, I'd say.
Yeah. And like, I mean, making a friend is like the thing. I mean, is the thing, you know? I mean, as we said at the beginning of this, like, you know, when I got back to New York and I didn't really, you know, I didn't really have any, I didn't have new friends. Like once I like met you and, you know, I met Rachel and I just met some people that like made me feel, you know, like, oh, this could be my home, you know? And then when I got my dog, I met a whole other like group of people that I was like, this is, you know, I really like, and I moved to Brooklyn. I was like, this is like a community and this is what I'm really, really looking for, you know? And like, once you find your community, then you're like, okay, this is my home. But it took me a long time to like find my home. I was not at home until I was in my mid 30s. So, and I think that, you know, Jillie, I, you know, maybe that's another thing that like I have in common with Jillie. It's like that sort of search for a home and finally finding it, you know, a little bit later in life than you think. You know, I think this is true of The Shortest Way Home, probably more, but you know, there are like these like markers that when you're little, people tell you like, this is the order your life is going to go in. And like, guess what? It's not going to, you know? And like, and that's disappointing when you first realize it, you're like, wait, you know, my like Nora Ephron life isn't happening, but like, then you have to kind of, once you move on from that, you can and accept it and find the right path that's your path. It's much better, you know?
Absolutely. We don't give late bloomers enough credit in our society as a whole, I would say.
Well, and it's funny because I was, you know, thinking about Nora Ephron and like, you know, in the essay that I published on LitHub last week, and like Nora Ephron was a late bloomer, you know? Like she married her like one true love when she was 56. I'll start again. So Nora Ephron was a late bloomer. Like she, you know, she met her like one true love when she was 54. She probably directed Julia and Julia when she was like in her like 60s, you know? So like for someone who was so mean about, you know, about getting older and wrote books called I Feel Bad About My Neck, she certainly was like the icon for it in so many ways.
Absolutely. And then, of course, I feel like one of the things that I really enjoyed about Jillian finding out what she likes is that, yeah, of course, she didn't have time when she was in high school to read for pleasure. But by college, she's reading The Giant's House by Elizabeth McCracken. And how life-changing is that?
I mean, it is. Like, when you realize that books aren't just, like, the boring ones that you get assigned in high school, it's a game changer. And, like, I mean, I didn't really read a lot of contemporary fiction until I was out of college, but, like, once I started doing it, I was like, oh, my God, it's so much better than, you know. like, I was just thinking the other, I had to do an interview for the book that where they asked me if there was a book I ever faked reading. And, like, I was like, I don't know if I've ever faked a book, reading a book. I mean, probably I have. But I know in high school they assigned us Billy Budd, and I, like, couldn't read it. I found it unreadable, and I read the Cliff Notes, and I'm like, why were they assigning us Billy Budd? Like, we were, you know, like, do something even remotely more relevant to a bunch of teenagers, you know, than, like, some maritime book, you know?
It's really interesting because I do think, and this is just anecdotal, like, that people even just a little younger than we are got to read more contemporary stuff. Like, Toni Morrison was really, like, a very much, like, assigned to people slightly younger than we are.
And, like, what a difference it would be to read books like that and, like, you know, and understand what, like, the power that books have versus being assigned things that are just, like, feel like that are a chore, you know? Like, Billy Budd is a chore that nobody on earth wants to do, you know? And, like, they should not have to. I'm sure it's not in curriculums anymore.
Yeah, that'll be interesting to, like, kind of compare and contrast.
Just think about how much, like, good young adult literature has been written since we were kids. I mean, you know, The Giver came out since we were kids that everyone reads, and, you know, I mean, things like that that are just different, you know, and better.
For sure. And so tell me a little bit about reintroducing Jillian to her high school crush slash foil slash, I don't know. You tell me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think, you know, like, there has to be a love story. And I sort of wanted it to be this kind of unrequited thing that, like, she had always thought about him, you know, on the back of her mind. And she never quite committed to anybody, you know, maybe as a result of that, maybe for other reasons, who knows. And so when, you know, she gets to school and he, you know, on the first day of school, like, he shows up with his daughter, it's like, oh no. This is, you know, like, is it fate? Is it, you know, who knows? But, you know, I think that just seeing him in person again, and she'd sort of, I think, kind of, like, hoped that she might see him and, you know, had done a little internet stalking herself to know that he was still there around. You know, that, I mean, it does add a little bit of excitement to the day and maybe, like, a little bit of, you know, incentive to move back and, you know, put on nice pants in the morning.
And tell me a little bit more about wine. I think, like, your first novel really brought home the fact that you learned so much. And so now you can just casually drop, like, adjectives that Jillian might use to describe the wine she's drinking.
Yeah, I mean, I had to do a lot of research for the first book. I did not do as much research for this one. But yeah, I mean, I've unfortunately, like, for good or for bad, like, I'm the person now who has to order the wine. So I have to have those words around. certainly, like, during the pandemic, I've, like, discovered some wines that I like and that I'm into, and, like, some of them are in the book. And I think, you know, like, wine is one of those things that's, like, intimidating, but, like, if you know four things about it, it's not anymore, you know? And so, and I think that's kind of true with a lot of things. I feel like it's true about, like, you know, music appreciation. Like, if you know, like, five things about jazz, you can talk about jazz, you know? And I think that maybe that's a result of, you know, my job on, you know, being a publisher, like, it's so wide ranging in terms of what you read and what you interact with. And, you know, I just have access to, you know, every kind of book. And I've been, and certainly in the past few years, because at Echo, we publish, you know, a really wide variety, especially of literary nonfiction and memoir and science. I've just been exposed to so much information, and I have a real love of nonfiction now that I, you know, didn't always have. And I think that, but I also have learned that, like, you can sound like an expert on a topic with, like, a, you know, just a certain amount of information. And that's why it's so fun to read, you know, like a book about, you know, if you read a book about a tree, I'm an expert on trees now.
For sure. Miriam, I don't like asking this question. I feel like a hack when I do, but you are the associate publisher of Echo. You have a 2.5-year-old daughter. You have a bratty but sweet dog. And you wrote a novel. And so how did you do this?
Well, I'm going to tell you the truth, which is I couldn't do it now. Having a 2.5-year-old is, like, actually way harder than having a baby. And I know, like, people are like, oh, having a baby, at least my baby was a really good baby. She is not the best 2.5-year-old. And so I wrote the first half of the book actually before she was born, the first 2/3 of it before she was born. And then she was born, and I finished it on maternity leave. Which was like the greatest gift ever. She was a very good napper and sleeper when she was a baby. She is no longer. But she's a good napper, not a good sleeper. And I revised it over the course of, like, the first year of her life, where she also was, like, a pretty good sleeper. And my husband Ben, like, would take her out of the house when I was like, I have to, like, get a chunk of this thing done, and I need to do it by, like, this Sunday night, you know? So, and she was little, and things were much easier when she was little. Things now are harder, to be completely honest. So, I'm not working on anything new. Like, I think I need I need some time until she grows up a little bit and my brain can kind of reacclimate to having ideas again. Like, right now I don't have a lot of ideas.
And on that note, do you have time to read for pleasure in the midst of all of this? And what are you reading?
Well, I do occasionally have time to read for pleasure. And it's funny, like, throughout the year, I, like, collect recommendations. And I, like, you know, because I'm looking at book coverage all the time. You know, all I do is read book coverage and read people's recommendations and, like, see people's book Twitter. So I'm like, God, what a nice life to, you know, be able to read whatever you want. But so I collect ideas. And then, like, when I have a free weekend, when I don't have to read for work, I'll pick up one of the books. So, which is funny, but people in publishing, I think, all do this, that, like, when you have a little free time, it's like, oh, I get to read, but, like, not for work. You
know? That's ultimate freedom.
Like, I do love reading for work. Like, the great thing about working at Echo is that we publish only books that I like. So so that's all good. But I recommend all Echo books. But the book that, like, really sort of has caught me recently and just, like, you know, made me just really spirited me away was Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow by Gabrielle Zevin. Like, speaking of the 90s and, you know, I mean, historical fiction set something, but.
Wait, sorry, we lost you for a second. Yep.
Okay. So historical fiction set, like, when you were in high school is, you know, maybe makes you feel old, but it was just a book that I connected with on, like, every single level. I love the main character. I love the video game stuff she was talking about. I loved I loved seeing the development of their company. I mean, I love a work novel, and, you know, that book is, it's a true delight. So if someone was going to, if someone was looking for something to really escape with, that's my recommendation. So, but I do also have a couple audiobook recommendations.
Ooh.
Like, audiobooks. Cause I have been I've been walking a lot, and I love to listen to audiobooks when I walk. And so, I loved, An Immense World by Ed Yong. It's so good. And if you love animals, there's a great chapter about dogs. And if you love animals, it's just so, so, so interesting. And again, it's, like, one of those books that, like, makes you feel like an expert when you're listening to it, which is fun. And Ed is a great reader. So listening to it.
Reader.
Yeah. You listened to the audiobook too, didn't you?
Yeah. I said it, yeah. Like, he sounds like a nature documentarian. Like, yeah. It's kind of amazing.
He's great. And then my other favorite audio I listened to this year is this book called Lab Girl, which came out a couple of years ago by Hope Jaron. But the audio is amazing. And this is how I'm a tree expert. Like, her, you know, her interstitials between each memoir chapter are about her tree research. And so you just learn so much. And you know, willow trees talk to each other. Like, you know, that's amazing.
Well, Miriam, thank you so much. Room and Board out now. Always a pleasure.
Thank you for having me. It's been a true joy.
Thank you for listening to the Maris Review, and check the show notes for the books we discussed on here today. And please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.